Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'd been selected for something special and don't expect to hear from me for a few days. And you're not to tell anyone. And we are creating a cover for you whilst you're away.
So he was really trying to play the role of the generous benefactor.
He certainly didn't come across as a sort of hard-nosed villain.
But the intercept had to take place within Hong Kong waters.
Got a, you know, an undercover narcotics bureau agent on our boat and taking him out for a sail.
And I was told, right, tonight's your last night ashore. Go and have a great run ashore, see all your girlfriends, and be back here first thing tomorrow morning, ready to go.
Catching Worms, a Hong Kong true crime podcast. August 1988. A boat had docked in Hong Kong Harbour. The yacht had made the four-day sailing from Manila and was stopping in Hong Kong to crew up to make a full six-week voyage down to Australia. It was also there to pick up an undisclosed cargo. The boat was skippered by John Bridges, and as he was suspicious of what that cargo might be, he had alerted the Australian consulate in Manila, who in turn had notified the Narcotics Bureau of the Royal Hong Kong Police. John had met with undercover officers Rod Mason and Bill Renwick and agreed to act as their informant, but he needed their support. So the team had come up with a plan. Undercover officers would be hired to be deckhands aboard the yacht. Whilst Rod was assembling the crew to man the boat, they also needed to think through every step of the sting. They needed to find someone who could help intercept the yacht out at sea. They couldn't just storm the boat in the port. This was an undercover operation, and they didn't want it to get out that they had arrested the smugglers. The Narcotics Bureau was looking at the bigger picture, thinking ahead, hoping that these drugs would lead them to the importers in Sydney. Therefore, they had to keep the bust a complete secret. They needed someone to intercept the yacht attempting to leave Hong Kong waters, but far enough out to sea that the operation couldn't be seen from land. Les Bird joined the Royal Hong Kong Police in 1976. After leaving school at the age of 19, he went in search of warmer climes and got bitten by the travel bug. Upon his return to the UK, in the midst of the recession, his cold and windy native shores offered few prospects. By contrast, Hong Kong had the allure of adventure, a different culture, danger. With naval history in his family, he was drawn to the Marine Police Division.
I was put immediately onto one of the command launches, which is the biggest launch, so I could work under a chief inspector and learn the ropes. That was the idea. And the type of boat the command launch would work for 3 days. It would go out to sea for 3 days and not come back. Then it would come back in and you would change duty, and I would then have 3 days off. So it was a 3-day on, 3-day off cycle. So you'd be at sea for 3 days, and then you come back. So, and what the biggest problem for Marine those days was illegal immigration. There was a lot. It was the end of the Cultural Revolution. You know, that was 1960s, but people were still leaving China in large numbers, or trying to come into Hong Kong in large numbers across the land border, which was now reinforced, and they had the Gurkhas and the police there. So people were trying to cross the bays and the inlets, both on the east and west of Hong Kong, and trying to come either by boat, or some of them actually tried to swim. Probably about the same age as me, in their early 20s, most of the illegal immigrants were kids, sort of ranging from about sort of late teens to mid 20s. Most of them were couples who were trying to make a break for it and make a new life. And I used to think when we used to pull them out of the water, and within 24 hours they'd be sent back, you know, which was a bit of an odd dynamic for me, because I, at the same age, I'd come to Hong Kong to start a new life, and there my first job was to stop other people doing exactly the same as what I'd done.
In the years that followed, Les's role as a Marine police officer offered all the adventures he was looking for, from commanding a remote outpost on the island of Lantau to engaging with pirates and intercepting ghost ships. So, by 1988, at the time of Operation Clinker, Les Bird was a seasoned Marine police officer used to policing some of the busiest shipping lanes in the world. As an experienced Marine police officer, Les Bird was called upon.
So when did you first hear about Operation Clinker? When do you remember the day that they said, "Hi, Les, I've got a job for you"?
Yeah, it did. It happened like that. I was a chief inspector at that time, and I was the commanding officer of the fast pursuit unit. And I got a phone call from the head of the Marine Police, and he said, "You've been chosen. You've been selected from a cast of thousands." To do a special duty with the Narcotics Bureau. And I said, okay. And he said, what I want you to do right now is go down to police headquarters, because I was at a forward operating base in the Northern New Territories. I want you to go down to police headquarters and report to the director of narcotics, not the Narcotics Bureau. And he will brief you on what it is. And you're not to tell anyone. You go down in civilian clothes, don't go in uniform, and you'll find out what it is. And we are creating a cover for you whilst you're away.
Away from his day job in the Marine Police, but also away from his friends and family.
What did your wife think about you suddenly going off and doing an undercover job?
Well, she didn't know. Someone had to phone her and tell her that I'd been selected for something special, and don't expect to hear from me for a few days. It was normal. It wasn't normal. She often used to get worried, but it was part of the job, so she just accepted it.
As an experienced officer, this wasn't the first time Les Bird had worked undercover.
I'd spent 6 months as the commanding officer of the Kowloon Special Duty Unit, which was an undercover job, mainly focusing on busting gambling dens and organised prostitution. So I did that in Mong Kok and Yam Tee for 6 months. So that was undercover. So I'd got sort of that experience.
But not all the team were as seasoned as Rod and Les. Bill Renwick was a new recruit, having only been out of training school for a few months. So for him, undercover work was a completely new world.
You know, I'd never done anything like this before, so I was just so nervous of just slipping up, just saying the wrong thing. It just could take a momentary slip of the tongue, and the whole thing is suddenly thrown into suspicion, and then it would be an uphill battle to kind of gain that advantage again.
Bill's ability to keep to his cover story was put to the test at the first meeting in the Spaghetti House. Across the table was the key suspect, Roberto, and they had to convince him to hire the full crew of undercover officers. It was easier than Bill expected.
Certainly in the evening where we all met, he was doing quite a lot of talking, which in a way surprised me. I kind of, again, was expecting to be grilled a bit, you know, and get a bit of the Spanish Inquisition. But he seemed to be, quite happy to talk a lot as well. Roberto clearly didn't really know much about sailing or what was involved in an ocean voyage at all. And so I think he was sort of, you know, when he came across the fact that Rod clearly knew what he was talking about and had this experience, that really, you know, made it a lot easier for us, I think, to get accepted, and because he sort of needed us, really.
I asked Rod and Bill their first impressions of Roberto.
Quite shifty. Clearly, he held the purse strings. He was very desperate to demonstrate that he was in charge financially. So, for example, when it came to leaving the Spaghetti House, he wouldn't hear anybody would contribute for the beers or the pizza that we'd eaten. He was in charge. He wanted to pay for it all. And he said things like, I'd mentioned something about smoking cigarettes. And so he would be, oh, don't worry, I'll buy all the cigarettes and we'll store them on board. So he was really trying to play the role of the generous benefactor.
Roberto was an interesting one because I just... Again, he just seemed a bit kind of like quite a sort of nice Filipino chap. He was a little bit prone to sort of bigging himself up and blowing his own trumpet. But generally seemed just, yeah, quite a sort of nice chap. He certainly didn't come across as a sort of hard-nosed villain.
Not particularly tall, not well built. I would call him a little bit thin, a bit, maybe you could call him a bit wiry. He was in his late 40s, early 50s, dressed in what I would say is a fairly traditional Filipino style collared shirt that buttons down the front with embroidery down each side.
So at this stage, you didn't, there was no physical threat from him. You didn't feel like he would be a physical threat.
No, correct. And we also had a support officer in the Spaghetti House who was a very large Chinese sergeant who basically met all four of us as the good guys and just been told, if anything goes wrong and we cause a fuss, then you stand up, reveal your police identity, and if necessary, pull out a firearm.
That backup would only be needed if the team couldn't keep their stories straight. Stories that have become so ingrained in their memories that over 30 years later, Bill can still remember his.
So mine, as probably most of the best cover stories are, wasn't too far away from the truth. So I was fairly fresh out of school, sort of traveling. My parents lived in Hong Kong and sailed a bit. I'd been over visiting them and doing a bit of sailing with them, but I wanted to carry on traveling and wanted to head on to wherever I could go. And when I'd heard about this chance of sailing down to Australia, that was that's what really appealed to me.
Each cover story had an element of truth, but they had to hold up to questioning and investigation. What if someone was checking them out?
But I'd moved up to stay with my parents during this time to, again, to maintain the cover story. And they were up on the peak at that point. And my little brother, who's he's 13 years younger than me, and I remember he had to be briefed on what would happen if someone rang and sort of what... Why was I at home? And, you know, he had to be told, no, the story is that, you know, I'm traveling. And so he had to be briefed on all that just in case he answered the phone and gave anything away. So he thought this was all tremendously exciting.
In a way, Bill's entire family became part of the undercover team and even helped Rod brush up on his sailing skills.
Again, all part of the cover story. Rod and I went off and did some sailing with my parents. We went over to Macau. So, yeah, which was great fun. Of course, they thought, wow, this is so exciting. We've got a, you know, an undercover narcotics bureau agent on our boat and taking him out for a sail. So, yeah, it was all very, very new and very exciting for all of us.
The team had impressed Roberto enough that he hired them all on the spot. But there was still a fair amount to do to convincingly get ready for a 6-week oceanic sailing voyage. and it made sense that the prep work aboard the boat would be tasked to the most experienced undercover narcotics inspector.
Rod was definitely in the role of the most experienced sailor, and you know he'd been in the Merchant Navy, so he had a lot more qualifications and experience than me. And so any of the prep work, sort of helping load up the boat or move it, things like that, that sort of fell to Rod, and we didn't really need to be involved.
I would go to the boat and what did we were doing general maintenance. I was also told that the fresh water tanks had sprung a leak, so I had to go and buy plastic jerry cans, which I did. I ended up buying about 20 in a couple of trips. And then I would splice a sort of 1 meter length of rope onto the jerry can, which is forming a loop and then binding the rope back into itself so that it's secure, so that the jerry cans could be tied around the decking on the Wii to put fresh water into.
The Wii, as in yes in French, was the yacht that John had purchased in Manila for this epic voyage across the South China Seas. But for the team of undercover officers, this was the location of Operation Clinker. Rod explains the boat's layout.
On the main deck's fairly flat, and then towards the rear, there was a cockpit that you could then sit down in, which was all around the helm and the controls for the engine. And from there, you could descend through a galleyway into the main cabin. The main cabin had, on the port side, a galley for food preparation. On the starboard side was sort of navigation equipment, the chart table, things like that. Up ahead in the forecastle was a small cabin which, because of the shape of the boat, had a V-shaped bunks. The main cabin had a bunk around the dining table and another one down the starboard side. And then in the stern behind the main cabin was what I guess you'd call the owner's cabin, which had a large double bed.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So this was a fairly tight layout for six adults to live for 6 weeks. But Rod had thought through the sleeping arrangements.
Yes, Roberta had taken over the main one. John was kipping in the main cabin. So basically, the four of us, we had worked out we would have to hot bunk. We wouldn't have a bunk that would just be ours and ours alone. There would be no more than two people sleeping at any one time. So we would just share bunks.
It's funny the way he talks about it. It's as if the cover story is so real that all the practical elements really had to be considered and prepped for, even down to where each member of the crew would sleep. though in reality, the team of undercover officers weren't planning to spend even one full night aboard the boat.
So, in that preparation week, you got to know Roberto a little bit better. Did you like him? Was he likeable?
He was quite grumpy. I would try and sort of chum up to him. He was always very interested in any girls that I met. And so I started playing up on that as a story, just making up nonsense about, you know, some great woman that I'd met in a bar and I was going to be seeing her tomorrow night. So I basically had to get away at 5 o'clock to go to my mate's house and get showered up and do my best. And the next day, he then asked me about, you know, my success rate and all this sort of stuff. So that was played on by me because it was something that he was interested in that I hadn't really had to work on to generate. So I just made up complete and utter nonsense and told him that.
Was there ever a moment that you thought your cover was blown, that you thought he knows something?
Yes, there was. Fortunately, not too early. And then after we'd been in the Aberdeen Marina Club for a couple of days, we moved down to Stanley and anchored in Stanley off St. Stephen's Beach. And that was supposedly our final move before departure for Australia. And I was told, right, tonight's your last night ashore. Go and have a great run ashore, see all your girlfriends and be back here first thing tomorrow morning, ready to go. So Roberto and I were taken to the main beach in Stanley, where the Smugglers Inn is located. Got ashore at the beach there and climbed up the steps. And as I came to the top of the steps, I saw standing outside the Smugglers, where they had a couple of big sort of whiskey barrel type tables, a group of off-duty police officers. And one of them saw me and shouted, "Hi, Rod." And I raised my hand and just waved and immediately turned and walked away. And Roberto said, "Who was that?" And so just hoping that they wouldn't follow, I just went, "Oh, some guy I met in a bar the other night. I think I owe him money. So if you don't mind, can we keep walking? I don't really want to see him." And Roberto just accepted that and off we went. But it made me think I was kind of pleased that I was using my name Rod and not calling myself Steve or something.
A close shave for Rod. But the rest of the crew had tried to keep themselves out of harm's way.
We also thought the less we are moving in and out and going to the boat or meeting up with Roberto or John, the better, really, because there's always the chance of being tailed back away. And you know, that's quite a concern if we were tailed back to somewhere that gave away our identity.
Places like the police headquarters. This operation had become a top priority.
It wasn't just the undercover operatives and my time, but they'd been under 24-hour surveillance since they arrived in Hong Kong. 24-hour surveillance is quite a lot of people, and that's not cheap.
This surveillance was key. The narcotics department needed to be sure the drugs were on board before their officers set sail.
I mean, the yacht itself was kept under static surveillance all night with people using infrared to watch activities on board. Roberto and John went off and drove into Tsim Sha Tsui, where they met another guy who actually turned out to be the main supplier of the heroin. They met him and they were then driven back in his car to St. Stephen's Beach, where they were joined by a third guy who was a very stocky, strong, muscled kind of triad kung fu fighter who was introduced, and we worked out, well, he was the bodyguard for the drugs. So they got back to the weir at about, I think it was something like 4 a.m. And they went aboard, and there were then lights on board the Wii for the next 2 hours. So surveillance said, something's going on. There's a lot of activity instead of people going to bed.
That night, there was a lot of activity, and they strongly believed the drugs were being loaded onto the boat. So we're back where we started this episode. Back to Les Bird, the experienced Marine police officer who received the call to be part of the boat tasked with intercepting the Wii.
And the drugs had already arrived in Hong Kong and they were under surveillance. So that's the state of play when I was called in. And I was told that they believed that they were going to put these drugs on a boat and send them down to Australia, where they would be, where the drugs would be distributed on the streets of Sydney by the Triad gang at the other end. And the plan was to intercept this ship, the yacht as it was leaving Hong Kong, so that the guys in Hong Kong didn't know, and then substituted everything, the boat, the drugs, and then carry on with the undercover operation all the way down to Sydney, and then hopefully arrest everybody down there. So I came in the week that they were suspecting that the drugs were going to be moved by boat from Hong Kong.
That was the plan. Next, Les was presented with the boat he had to use to undertake the mission.
And I said later on, why didn't you tell me this before? And I could have helped you select a much better pleasure craft, a motorized yacht, because the yacht that we used was really not very suitable for the job. So when I was taken down to Causeway Bay Typhoon Shelter to have a look at it, the first thing I said was, why have you chosen this particular boat? Because it's not very seaworthy. It doesn't have a radar. What happens if we try and do an interception at night in the complete darkness without a radar? And they were like, well, I don't know. It's okay, isn't it? It'll do. I said, well, it will do, but you know, if you'd asked me a couple of weeks ago, I could have helped you pick a much better boat. Anyway, I asked them to change it, and they said, no, there's not enough time. It's taken forever to get the funding to do this, so we're going to have to use this one.
So you didn't just take a police boat out there and then just, like, no, you know, arrive on the scene. Why were you on a pleasure boat? What was the thinking behind that?
Well, this was the NB plan. This was the plan that was given to me. Whoever put this together decided that a pleasure boat with 5 expats on board, dressed in Hawaiian shirts and cans of beer, wouldn't raise the alarm on the drug smuggling boat. They would think we were just a bunch of guys out having some fun. And then in the meantime, I would then maneuver this boat close in, and we would sort of wave and shout and say, hi, how are you doing? You know, and then at the last minute, I was then required to sort of bring our motorboat alongside the yacht, and the 4 INB guys were going to cross over, and Rod and Bill were going to overpower the crew on board the yacht. So that was the loose plan.
The other 4 NB guys weren't probably experienced or in boat. No. So you were on your own. It was all down to you.
Yeah. That occurred to me.
So the intercept was all down to Les. And even though he laughs about it now, at the time he had some serious reservations.
What were your main concerns? What did you think could go wrong?
A lot. Firstly, the motor cruiser that we got was not really built for heavy weather. It was a very light boat. And when I looked at the chart and saw where the interception would probably take place, it's right on the southern eastern part of Hong Kong waters, which is open to the South China Sea and the Pacific. And having worked in that area for 10 years, I know that the waves that come in and the weather comes in from the southeast, and you get these huge rollers, these huge waves come in. They don't break, but they throw a boat all over the place. And in the previous 10 years, I've been involved in dozens of search and rescue operations of boats in distress boats like ours that had gone out there and got into trouble. And I'm thinking, now I'm going to go out there in one of these sort of lightweight boats without a radar. And no one seemed to think that radar was really very important. But at night, in darkness, you actually can't see anything, right? Particularly if the other boat has no light, not showing any lights, you can't see it. On with a radar, you can. And I said, where's the radar? Well, I didn't think we needed one. Well, it would have helped, you know. So we had a very unstable boat with no radar. And having been involved in so many search and rescue and seeing other boats get into difficulty in heavy weather, I realized that we weren't that well prepared in a maritime sense. And yet here I was in charge of the maritime aspect of the operation in a boat that I wouldn't really have chosen.
And Les wasn't the only one who had some concerns.
One of the other problems, I should say, Rod and I had a long conversation about whether we should be armed or not, but we would be in just shorts and T-shirts, you know, and just sort of casual boat wear. There's nowhere really to hide a gun. And plus, we didn't really want things to come to that. So Rod did have a gun in his hold all, which we could get to if we needed it.
I had taken and concealed a firearm which had a lock through the trigger. It's a very simple locking mechanism, but with it there, it meant that you could not pull the trigger on this firearm. You needed to have a key to undo the lock. Now, we hoped we would not need it, because if you needed a firearm, it meant that something very urgent was going on. And you didn't really want a delay to have to undo a trigger lock to have access to it. So we basically said, well, if it comes to it that we need it, then somebody has to recover it and point it at the bad guys and just shout warnings at them and hope that they didn't realize there was a trigger lock in it. The whole point of the trigger lock was so that if one of the bad guys had discovered the weapon, it couldn't be used against us.
Next time on Catching Worms.
We stumbled through it, to be honest.
And an arrangement for the handover of the bag containing the purported drugs was made.
Rod did have a gun in his holdall, which we could get to if we needed it.
The whole point of the trigger lock was so that if one of the bad guys had discovered the weapon, it couldn't be used against us. Which didn't stop him sort of swinging his right hand, trying to stab me repeatedly.
Killing someone, we're there to arrest people, not to drown them. So
they're firing at me. I was on the flying bridge.
This has been a Create podcast. Make sure you hit the subscribe or follow button so you never miss an episode. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then please leave us a review and a 5-star rating. It helps others to find us. You can follow us on Instagram at CatchingWormsHK. With special thanks to Rod Mason, author of Operation Clinker, Bill Renwick, and author of Small Band of Men, Les Bird. And thank you for listening.
Catching Worms. Zhuk Chong. This term means to get yourself into trouble, causing unnecessary difficulties. It may seem like an odd phrase, but this slang is often used as an abbreviation of the full saying 捉蟲入屎忽, that involves putting said worms up your rear end, which to anyone's imagination definitely spells trouble indeed.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.